So, James, real quick, what episode is this?
82.
Okay. Got it. Hello.
It's been over a month, you know.
It's been a while. Yeah.
So did you have a question?
I have a question. You know, my bathroom's been giving me some pains. And the house was built in 1970, 71-ish.
Oh, that's the best year.
So what do you suggest? I have to get it redone. Should I stick with that late mid-century, post-mid-century aesthetic? Or what do I do? That's my design question.
Post-mid-century what?
Aesthetic.
I don't know that that's an aesthetic. What are you trying? In the 70s?
I don't know. I'm just saying.
Late, early 70s would have been late 60s. So if it was, in fact, designed, which I highly skeptical of because it's in Phoenix. So
right. Well, know, of course.
This is not the cutting edge of the design world. So God knows what it would have originally looked like.
Avocado.
Okay, so that actually is 70s. Yeah. Oh, no, definitely. Brown and avocado is definitely the way to go, right? Because you want not only to feel dark, but also oppressed.
I was hoping the other bathroom was yellow. That's the only tile that I can't remove from the house unless I do a lead abatement. But in the other bathroom.
Just paint over it. I like white limited areas. Like if your whole house is white, you're a horrible person.
It's not.
But if you go all in white in one room, it can be really nice. And the bathroom isn't a bad place to do that because it's contained, it's small. Mm-hmm. And you can just do white porcelain everywhere because that's really cheap because everything is white porcelain. And if it's all white, it's kind of overwhelming. So just do white.
Okay.
I will allow you to, that's the whole point. White has to be white. If there's any accents, it needs to be in the service of white. So okay. The only thing that can make anything look whiter is something that's a little bit off-white. If you have a little bit of off-white trim or something, that can just highlight the fact that everything else is just really super white.
Okay.
You don't like that, do you?
No, I don't know what I like anymore. Everything I do just gets effed up. So
you know, this is, I guess, reminiscent of how I used to treat the artists that I would represent at the gallery.
Okay.
These goddamn artists would come in and they'd be like, okay, so we're going to have a show. We'll have some pieces. These are the pieces. And then I would ask them, what are the prices we're looking at for these? And they're like, oh, I don't know.
Oh, no. Seriously?
Could you be a professional and come in with your prices in mind rather than giving them this nonsense? But okay, so I found the most effective way to deal with that was to lowball them. And I'd be like, all right, well, $100 sound okay to you? And they're like, oh, no, it's got to be more than that. Yeah, no shit, Sherlock, it's got to be more than that. You poke them, though, and you poke them to the point where they push them into the direction that they don't want to go. And then they start coming up with their own ideas. It's like when you say, okay, well, if you don't know, then I'm just going to do my own thing. And, you know, you're not going to like that. So what is the point at which we get to the point where you do like it?
Oh, me?
You were the artist. That was the thing. You just keep increasing the price until they get to the point where they start to get comfortable. And, look at that. You do actually know how much you want to sell these things for. You just didn't bother doing the work on your own. You made me do it.
Or they were embarrassed or they didn't thought it wasn't worth it. Who knows what they thought?
I dealt with enough of them that they hadn't really put a lot of thought into it. And they thought they didn't really want it. It's hard for me to express it because I have such rage around it that do the work before you get there. That's all I'm asking.
Yeah. Now I've been doing the work and I can't come up, you know, like we had the hearing and, you know, it's clear that this bathroom needs to be redone. I had 4 estimates and everyone was just horrified at what they saw.
All right. So I'm going to do the same thing to you. The base, since you clearly didn't like the white idea, I know you didn't express that to me, but I can read between the lines. You didn't like that idea. That's the base. So start adding to it to the point where you get comfortable. All right. So is there any part of the bathroom that you look at and you think white would be okay for?
Yes, I do. I actually was thinking white. With some sort of like either a decorative or a colorful splash of some sort. And I was wondering if I could do white, you know, even if I had to go back to the subway tile routine, which I'm not keen on anymore. It's just been so painful with the last one, the last installation. or if I could do like an 8x8 or something like a bigger tile with then splashes of color that were in that like mid-century palette.
Well, what is that mid-century palette?
You know, the avocado, the yellow,
that's
the,
not mid-century.
You know, terracotta, not mid-century. I'm talking 70s.
And now you're just naming all the colors.
Yeah, like, could it be like a mixture of like colors, or would that be just visually disturbing? You know, what if you threw in like a little terracotta, a little yellow, a little like, you know, lighter brown, a little green, a little blue?
I think you'll have to figure out what tones you want. You know, okay. Pick a tone maybe.
Yeah, I mean, just keep it in the same value, but have these different
It sounds
colors.
Like you have an idea, though.
I do have an idea. Okay. I just didn't know, since you're the
there
designer.
You so
I'm
you,
just
you're
like
lying
the
about
schmuck.
It. Right. No, I get it. You just want me to do all the work for you. Right.
Yeah, I just wanted you to give your opinion.
I say, without knowing the tones you're talking, I mean, you say blue and terracotta and brown and
like those kind of muty, you know.
Right.
I'll say,
you didn't say that, though. It's like you have to come up with a palette.
Yeah.
Just play with a palette.
Okay.
You know,
because I think
doing.
I know what I want. I'm just not sure where to get it. And I sure don't know who the hell's going to install it. And it's just a mess. But let's move on. I mean, enough about my bathroom. How was your summer so far?
It was great until I got back here.
What happened?
I haven't left the house in 2 weeks.
I know, right?
It's too hot to go out and do anything.
It is.
So, you know, I had a great vacation, and then I come back and I immediately get cabin fever.
Right. I feel that. I really do.
I would say that the trip to the national parks was somewhat muted by my my growing concern over being attacked by a bear.
Oh my God.
So
someone got
go...
attacked by a bear, didn't they? Was it up there in Yellowstone?
Someone just got... this is what I was trying to say, is that I was preoccupied with bear attacks, so I didn't hike as much as I wanted to. And it was really wonderful because I would get to a hotel, and most of the hotels that I stayed at had hiking guides or someone there, a concierge. Concierge.
Oh,
or,
nice.
You know. And so I'd go up to them and I would say, you know, what are the hikes like, you know, over here versus over there? Because I had several hikes planned out. And I said, what's the bear activity like? And they'd be, oh, it's really high this year. Like, that's not what I want to hear.
Right.
I want to hear that, oh, there are no bears. They're all gone. They're still hibernating. No, but they were so excited to tell me how many bears there were. I'm like, I want the opposite of that. You know, I didn't do a lot of hikes because of the overwhelming bear. And so I get back, and like yesterday there was news that, or maybe it was today, a hiker was killed by a bear in Yellowstone. Like, okay, that's why, you know, I don't really like hiking in Yellowstone. And yeah, I did not like Yellowstone that much.
Really? I've never been up there.
Teton and Glacier were better, but it was mostly because of the tourists, or as one of the hotel guides explained, Torons. She called them Torons.
Like morons, but tourists.
Yes, yeah, you got it just as quickly as I did. Yeah, because this is what they would do in Yellowstone Park. Catherine, you familiar with bison?
I love bison. I don't
you
eat
love
it.
Love bison. Well, I have eaten.
They're just cute.
A lot of bison, and I will eat as much bison as I can from now on.
Oh, I've never eaten bison.
I hate the goddamn thing so much now. Okay. They are mangy, mutated cows. They're awful looking creatures. They're brown.
Mm-hmm.
They're dirty.
They're very dirty.
And they're mangy. Like, especially during the summer, they're molting or whatever. So, like, they're...
Do they stink?
Falling off. I didn't get close enough to find out. But I'm guessing they don't
smell. They look
like
smelly.
Roses.
Mm-hmm.
They're not an animal that I didn't go to Yellowstone for the animals anyway. I don't want to see bears, and I don't want to see animals. I just want to see the landscape. I want to hike through the landscape. But those goddamn tourists there are so in love with bison. These horrible, disgusting animals, that they will stop in the middle of the road and cause an hour-long backup just to stop in the middle of the road, because you could pull off to the side of the road and not block traffic. But no, they stop in the middle of the road, get out of their cars, and run around taking pictures of bison if they're within like 100 yards of the road.
I thought I read that some woman got gored by a bison or killed by a bison.
Boy, I wish that would happen more often.
I think that happened.
These people deserve it. And you can watch as you get closer to the bison encounter, you know, a period of 45 minutes as you slowly drive closer to this blockage. People stopping one by one, getting out and running out and taking pictures. This is a 45 minute to hour long backup just because of this. And that gets a little tedious pretty quick.
Oh my God.
The most bizarre thing I think has ever happened to me in my entire life is, unfortunately, my parents had decided they were going to try to get out there a couple days early and get acclimated.
Oh, it was a whole family deal?
Yeah, everyone.
I didn't know that. Oh, my God. Yeah. That had to be.
No, that was great.
I'm sure it was great. Yeah.
Unfortunately, their flights got completely foobarbed. They wound up showing up several days late because their first plane got canceled. And I think it was United they were flying, or was it Delta? I can't remember now. Canceled their flight.
Really?
The airline got confused.
Because of the smoke?
No. The airline got confused when they were rerouting them and accidentally canceled their flight. So they had no flight. So they had to basically rebook. And this was at a time in July when there was a little bit of a backup because of the weather, and then everybody was flying. And so it was completely foobarbed. So they got out there about a week late. And that meant that me and my siblings were already out there, and we were going to go pick them up, but we'd already gone from Teton to Yellowstone, and so it was going to be backtracking several hours to go pick them up. No big deal. But my sister and my sister-in-law are both so much more intelligent than I am, and so much more on top of getting things scheduled and being responsible. They're just more
right,
responsible.
Right.
At the beginning of this one day when we have to go and pick them up, I'm not really part of the conversation because I'm not responsible enough to be responsible for things like this. But I am aware that they're coming in and their new flight may be delayed again because that's air travel in the United States these days. But I am aware of the general facts and aware of the general idea that we need to be back at the hotel by 4 p.m. to make sure that we can go get them when their flight lands. So I get back at 4 and no one's there, you know, and like, well, we can leave at 5 and get there on time because I didn't know their flight number. But right. Thankfully, there aren't a lot of flights that go into Jackson Hole. So I was able to figure out which flight they were on. And it was delayed, but not delayed that much. And so I figured, well, if we leave by 5, we'll be fine. And I was waiting for my sister or sister-in-law to show up. Neither of them did.
Oh, wow.
So at 5 o'clock rolls around, like, does this mean I have to go and pick up my parents? Am I the responsible one? Turned out I was.
Oh, my God.
So I left just in time to get there to pick them up when their flight lands. But you know what happened, Catherine?
What happened?
On my way out of Yellowstone.
Mm-hmm.
I ran into an hour-long backup because people were watching the bicycle.
No way.
So instead of me being there on time, I was almost an hour and a half late because of these morons who stopped in the middle of the road to look at the damn bison. So my father, who is quite disabled now, was, sitting in the airport at 9 p.m. Waiting for his son to arrive.
Aw.
Well, obviously his daughter-in-law's, but they're... And, I get back and like, oh, you picked him up. Great. It's like, yeah. That's a 6-hour round trip. You're welcome.
Oh my God.
That was a really long, boring story.
No, that was good. I'm so sorry to hear that, but at least everyone made it safely to Yellowstone.
Yeah.
And well, you made it out of Yellowstone.
Yeah. I think Teton and Glacier were both better.
Okay. I've never been up there. I'm not much of a hiker, as you can imagine.
You don't have to do a lot of hiking. You can see, especially in Glacier, there's this road that goes through the park, and you can drive the road and just be overwhelmed by the
beauty,
wild natural beauty.
Wow. Of the bison. Yeah, I don't eat bison.
No. Bison? Thankfully, I didn't see any bison in Glacier. I'm not saying they're not there. It's more mountainous, so there probably are fewer of them.
Okay.
Maybe Yellowstone is there's a lot more flatlands and rolling prairies in Yellowstone, so you get a lot more of those idiot bison.
Got it.
And idiot people looking. I guess it's not the bison that I'm so upset with. It's the people. My God, I hate people.
I'm getting there.
I hate people who spend too much on paintings too as well.
Yes.
Can you imagine spending 86 million pounds, British pounds?
No.
On an unfinished painting?
No.
Let me think for a second here. If you were making $18 an hour.
Yeah.
That was about $36,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
You worked for 55 years.
Right.
Your total income over those 55 years would be about $2 million.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So if you spent $86 million on a painting,
mm-hmm.
literally that's the equivalent of 44 people working their entire career.
That's crazy.
For one painting. I'm starting to think maybe our system is a bit whacked out that one person can have so much extra wealth, they can just blow money on an unfinished painting that would be equivalent to 43 people's entire, I was going to say yearly.
That's an interesting way to look at it.
Their entire life's income. 43 people's entire life's income. And then you have some idiot writer trying to justify that this is the best Klimt painting. And just to cut to the chase, which I think it was a she. Let me double check now. I've forgotten who wrote this nonsense. Written by Kelly Grover. So I could be a he or she as far as I know. Kelly. Or Grovier? Grovier. Let's go with Grovier because it sounds stupider.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly, their final thought was, it's quote, unfinishedness is what completes it. Oh,
right. We're talking about Klimt's Lady with the Fan, the painting that sold for 85.3 million pounds, which is equivalent to what? Like, what did you say? Like $110 million US dollars?
Yeah, roughly.
Roughly.
Yeah. So it's actually more than 43 people's entire
right.
Life's
US dollars
work.
Wise. Yes. Yes. I think the painting is interesting, and I like the Chinese, I called it appropriation earlier, but that's, let's just say, influence.
Yeah.
And, you know, talk a little bit about how the Impressionists just, you know, kind of riffed off the Chinese aesthetic.
Well, I think that's what kicked off post-Impressionism, when the Impressionists started to see the imports from the Japanese prints, mm-hmm. which, I don't know if this is apocryphal, but one of the stories in art history is that the prints that these guys started seeing weren't seeing the prints being imported for themselves. They were seeing the prints because they were wrapping Japanese ceramics and other hard goods mm-hmm. in the prints, because the Japanese didn't, you know, they were like newspapers to them. So they would wrap their porcelain and fine china and stuff like that in the prints.
Oh,
and then
wow.
The artists were seeing, like, unwrapping and then looking at the prints and being gobsmacked because this was not an aesthetic heritage they were familiar with. So that kind of revolutionized how they started thinking about it, and it started flattening their work. And Van Gogh and other artists, impressionist artists, were influenced, and this kicked off or helped to kick off post-impressionism.
Very cool. I didn't know that. That's interesting.
So that's art history. So, you know, it's probably not true.
I like it, though. It's a great story.
Yeah. That's,
isn't it?
You know, that's just what sells. If it sells, you know.
Oh, it's like newspapers to them.
It doesn't matter. Exactly. Newsprint. It doesn't have to be true to be newsworthy.
Mm-hmm. True. I'm familiar with that. I thought it was really interesting. I was kind of more intrigued with
the
language in the article than I was with the painting.
Oh, well, that's the whole point. She's not trying to, or Kelly is not trying to really explain to us why the painting is important, because it's really not. Kelly is just trying to impress us with their manipulation of the English language, and what a wonderful writer they are.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they're saying is nonsensical. You know, its completeness comes from the fact that it's unfinished. I can see a world in which that might be true of something, uh-huh. where you intentionally leave something out to make it complete, to finish it.
Right.
This is not that, though. This is clearly unfinished. And I say that. So there were two unfinished works on his easel, on Klimt's easels, when he died. This is one of them.
Right.
This painting that just sold for 86 million pounds.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at them side by side, they both have very distinct Klimt elements to it.
Mm-hmm.
On Lady with the Fan, this one we're talking about, very clearly the outline of the person is Klimt from like beginning to end. But the background does not look Klimt-like at all. It's almost a little bit more like Chagall, but it's also just way too vibrant and brutalist, almost, in a way, to be a final Klimt. So I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, this is either an experiment gone awry for Klimt,
mm-hmm.
or it's just an underpainting. This is not going to be a final Klimt, because, again, if you just look at the other painting that was right next to it in the studio, you see all the standard Klimt hallmarks. It's
right.
Subtle, it's explosion of patterns,
mm-hmm.
but only in certain areas. And it's much more not reserved, but well-balanced and well-drawn.
Right.
And the background elements here are not well-drawn. They're quite crude, both in their drawing and in their color implementation.
I'll link that in the show notes, because that kind of explains it visually.
But the writer of this article is really trying to elevate this work as to being one of the best Klimts. But the whole thing reads like an excuse, you know, trying to make up a reasons why this would be good.
Mm-hmm. And again, when I was reading this, I thought, you know, I wonder what people would think. I mean, I wonder what Klimt would think if he read this. You know, was he really going that deep? Or was he just, like you said, experimenting? Or, I mean, what was happening?
I think he would be appalled that a piece that was unfinished
mm-hmm.
would sell for this much, or even be sold at all. Stand this next to all the Klimts, literally the one he was working on or decades earlier, and you can see how much more finished and refined and mm-hmm. beautiful and artistic they are.
Mm-hmm.
And this one doesn't meet those criteria. Okay, the figure is executed perfectly, plimpt-wise. And it looks mm-hmm. finished, but the background is clearly not.
No, and the there background are patches, is clearly not.
As the article points out, there are patches of it that are literally have no paint on them.
I'm looking at it right now.
And I also think Kelly's interpretation of the figure is just flat out wrong. And it's like this is like Kelly's never seen a Klimt before. Mm-hmm. Klimt is no stranger to nudity and to figures who are generally don't seem to care about their nudity. You know, there's no
vulnerability.
Sense. Oh no, there's no vulnerability, but there's no sense that they're embarrassed by it.
Right.
By but so this is what Kelly says, I quote, that she, the portrait of the painting, that she hasn't noticed our intrusion into the intimate space that she inhabits, bedroom or boudoir, seems clear enough from the unheeded slip of an ornate robe down mm-hmm. her arm and the tentative hold that her fingers have on the folding fan that shields her breast, a perilous prop that feels a flimsy flick away from falling. I look at that painting and I get a very different sense from it. I look at that painting and I look at a woman who has a very intent gaze. Mm-hmm. We don't know what she's looking at. That's part of the interesting part of the painting is we don't know what she's looking at, but mm-hmm. she's very intently engaged in something that she's looking at. She's got the fan up covering her breast.
Yes.
But it's in a strange way that it's like almost not caring, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, if she really cared that she was partially nude, she wouldn't let her the sleeve slip down over her shoulder, exposing her.
Mm-hmm.
But she just holds the fan up there like she's very confident about holding the fan the way she is. It's like it's enough for her.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
It totally does. And the gaze to me, when I looked at this, like my first impulse was like she's in like the fan and the drapage. I felt like she was, I don't know, like maybe turned around and saw like her cheating lover. And it was like kind of a gaze, like that intent gaze of like, you know, like,
yeah, there's
you know,
something in that gaze, it's
you know, and like she's holding up the fan, like you can get down with this sick beat, but you didn't, you know, it's like, I don't know.
She's holding a fan almost more for us than for herself.
Right.
It's like she's saving us our embarrassment, not hers, because she's, and that was one of the things with Klimt. He painted a lot of ballerinas and models
mm-hmm.
who were very used to performing in front of people. So maybe that was the feedback he gets a lot through from his paintings mm-hmm. is that there's a confidence there in being the object of our gaze.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense now that I think about it.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting painting. Is it his best work? Is there saying? I don't think.
Well, this painting, it's a terrible painting.
Yeah, I liked it.
I think it's an interesting note. It's like, yes, this is one that he painted, but clearly does not match the quality of his other work.
Right, and it was on his easel when he dies. Maybe he wasn't feeling well. I mean, he died from pneumonia or something?
It's, yeah, it's well, after a stroke as well. It's unclear if he worked on this at all after he had a stroke. Understanding is, I don't think there's any clear evidence one way or the other. They said some people say that he was unable to paint after his stroke.
Oh, I see.
So, and that happened, I think, in late 1917 or early 1918.
Okay.
And then he got pneumonia and died while I was in hospital. So it's unclear whether he did this before or after he had a stroke. If it was after a stroke, you know, if he's doing that background, it makes sense that he kind of lost his stuff because his background is painted so badly.
Right.
But the whole essay seems like a desperate attempt to draw lipstick on a pig and defend the idea that this is worth 85 million pounds.
Agree, 100%. It just goes back to everything we've talked about on this podcast in terms of the art world. Like you said at the beginning, you know, how much money and who makes these prices up? I don't know. I just love the thought of like a choreographed clash of pattern, pigmented and texture that fix her in this alluring stylized elsewhere.
It's an interesting piece of prose, but it doesn't have anything to do with the painting.
I know. Can you transport me to an alluringly stylized elsewhere? That just sounds good to me.
You can do that through your own artwork. That's what. Yes. That's the point. Go make some of your own artwork.
I've been working on some stuff, interestingly.
Well, there you go.
And then, you know what? I don't know. I was just kind of experimenting. I have so much crud in this house, and I found, and it's so toxic, I need to stop. But I found like all these old nail polishes and the pigments are just like freaking amazing.
Mm, yeah.
And so I bought these big silicone mats and I just started pouring it all over and letting it dry and then peeling it off. And then I was going to affix it to something. Well, in the process of doing that, my poor dog my poor Chance, just started coughing. And it didn't even dawn on me. I wasn't working in the studio. And I had to take him to the doctor. And he had changes in his lungs, like lung changes. We did like, and he's like, what the hell's going on? And then it dawned on me after the fact that he'd only started coughing a couple days after I started this painting project or this pouring of the whatever. And now I stopped. I need to get all my stuff in the back again, where I have proper air filtration and everything. I mean, I was just doing it on the kitchen table. The whole house smelled like nail polish. It was like a salon.
Well, that's even so, that may not be enough of an impact to affect the dog. So don't assume it was you. There's been a lot of dust.
There was a lot of dust. I mean, but talk about the workup, man, you know?
Yeah, you probably shouldn't be pouring nail polish in your kitchen.
Probably not. Actually, not. But I didn't want to waste it. And I don't really like painting my nails anymore. And a lot of the colors were just really funky. It was like, you know, Cheryl and I would go to this nail polish store over by the dim sum place we go to. And it's just like, and everything looked fun. We'd be like, oh, that's so fun. And she actually brought me all of her nail polish. And I just started pouring. I'm like, I'm not going to use it on my toes or my fingers. I might as well not waste it. You know, the environment.
I get that. I mean, there's a lot of pigments there that you can use, a lot of crazy colors and spectrum.
Oh my God. And they are so brilliant.
Yeah.
They're just beautiful. So anyway, so that's all I got. So yeah, I will start exploring my own otherness, whatever the hell she said, stylized elsewhere. I think.
Well, I'm going to quote the last two.
Yeah, you've got it. You've got to. That's just precious. Go for it.
And it says, I was going to do the whole paragraph, but I'll just do the last two sentences instead. But this is a painting whose very power issues from flux and fragmentation. Its unfinishedness is what completes it. No, it's a bad painting that would have been burned or fixed.
Mm-hmm.
It's better because it's not finished? Doesn't that suggest that Klimt didn't really have volition over his own work, and doesn't that make him a bad artist?
Yeah, it seriously does look unfinished. And the further down you go, the more unfinished it looks.
When you look at it, if you take it out of context and just look at it as a work itself, it's an interesting work. It's not a bad work because it's Klimt, but there are bad parts to it.
Right.
And once you start putting it next to other Klimts, it becomes so obviously bad.
I know. When are we going to paint something? You particularly, you're very talented, that I can auction off for like 85.
I think we have a much better chance with your fake weyats.
The fake weyat. I love that fake weyat.
You do. Why don't you do more of those?
He's hanging up.
We can put a show on. We can buy it like an old truck or something and put a show on in a mobile art gallery.
We should. You want to do that? I'm not kidding. When it cools off.
Well, we can do it in your bathroom.
When it cools off and like.
We'll do a show in your bathroom.
2025.
You know, Martin Mull did that once. Martin Mull was actually a painter. He studied painting at the Rhode Island School of Design before he became a comedian.
I knew that. But that's awesome.
I think it was at MoMA or maybe it was the Met.
Mm-hmm.
The Met. Those are different museums, by the way. Mm-hmm. Catherine. who gets them confused.
I know. Sleep deprivation does wonders for like everything.
Well, he was in New York and he couldn't get a show anywhere. Mm-hmm. So he and a couple of friends did put on a show in the bathroom of the Met.
Love it.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I think we could get like a truck. Don't you have a truck?
Why the hell? I have a Prius.
Oh, you have a Prius. That's right. Because we could just rent like something. I went to like a First Friday many, many moons ago, and they had these little pop-up kind of, they were literally not, it was like a 10-foot.
Dumpster thing. Are you talking about a container?
Yeah, it was like a container. It's like a 10-foot container. And they just had the door flung open, like the kind, you know, that just would fly open. Maybe some of them were 40-foot. And they had like maybe 5 or 6 of these. And that's what the artist did. And you just walked in like up the step into this container and there was shit in the walls. And then he walked out and into the next container. And it was actually kind of cool. They just parked him there for First Friday. And then the next day they were gone.
Yeah. You need to have a actual 18 wheeler though to move those.
Yes, exactly. And I'm sure it wasn't just.
Not a Prius.
Yeah. I'm sure it just wasn't like well, let's just do this and be avant-garde. It was a very thought out. It was the whole thing was part of an installation. I mean, it wasn't, you know, just, you know, ad hoc or someone just got Got it. But, you know, we could do something like that. We can rent a U-Haul.
Yeah, sure we could. But I think the important point here is that I think we have the answer to your bathroom conundrum. Just scrape everything off of your bathroom down to the studs and pour nail polish over it all.
That would look so much better than what it looks like now.
And it would be sealed.
It would be sealed.
And if you ever want to remove it, you could just use nail polish remover.
Yeah, or wait, or peel it. Sometimes you peel the peelies.
Ugh, I don't know what that means. I don't
like you
it
just
though,
peel so. Off your nail polish. It's just horrible. It's just horrible. Yeah, they actually have nail polish you can put on your nails that causes it to be able to be peeled off without ripping the nail bed, like the nail, actual the nail. And there's a YouTuber. It's called Simply Nailogical. She's adorable. And she has a whole peely bag. And I've always wanted to her peely bag and just make
like
art
where
out of it.
This is going. I think I can't deal with any. This is no.
It's just nail polish peel.
No.
Okay. I think it's time to end.
Yeah.
You killed me, James. You killed me. I know.